תגוסוק אינונה ברושותן אדוק קושו ניגין יערבין אינונה איזווית קימן נורפת ביארר קוצי גרין נקונק נניה Inuim Nayarimi.
Hello and welcome to Ocean Research Project. I am Matt Rutherford, sitting on a 54-foot Beneteau sailing along in the Atlantic Ocean. I'm about 100 miles south of Cape Hatteras and delivering a boat. This is delivery season, and I do a lot of deliveries this time of year. So I'm bringing up a Beneteau 54 up from the Bahamas, heading to Galesville, Maryland, which is just south of Annapolis. And, you know, this time of year, there's a lot of boats heading north. And then again, in the fall, a whole lot of boats will head south. So it's just normal for me this time of year to be out in the ocean. We do have a little bit of weather come in this evening. I got to make a bit of a decision. There's going to be a system coming off of Hatteras right around the time we're supposed to arrive, blowing anywhere from 20 knots out of the east, which isn't that bad, to 35 knots out of the northeast. You really, really don't want to be going around Hatteras if you have 35 knots out of the northeast, or basically any wind that opposes the current. It makes for very dangerous steep seas, and it's best avoided. So probably what we're going to end up doing is heaving to for 5 or 6 hours. It's a very fast moving system, so it's not going to last terribly long, and I'll heave to just south of it on the east side of the Gulf Stream and let it pass, and then get back under sail and cross the Gulf Stream at Hatteras and continue on to the Chesapeake Bay. Everything's going pretty good for the most part. I don't know if you can hear the water washing by. I'm sitting in the V-berth of this boat. This is actually my crew's quarters. I am the captain, so I sleep, you know, I don't sleep forward of the mast if I can help it. But anyways, this is the best place to do this podcast at this point because it's the quietest place on the boat. So everything's pretty good. I got a bit of an upset stomach. I ate something weird. I don't know what it is. I was actually doing a delivery a few weeks ago. I brought a Tiana 48 up from Brunswick, Georgia, to a marina just south of Annapolis. And I made the complete dumbass decision. There was this really good beef stew that was cooked. And this beef stew had sat out for like 24 hours in the heat and got all nasty. And I was about to dump it overboard. And I was curious to see if it was still warm, because it was in this like device that's supposed to keep things warm for a really long time. So I stuck my finger in it, and it didn't feel that warm. And just out of habit, I put my finger in my mouth, and on the surface, my finger was covered with like this congealed, rotten, fat nastiness from this beef stew. And I didn't even think about it. Like, out of habit, I just put my finger in my mouth to like clean my finger off, and I got food poisoning. So that night, delivering this boat, you know, middle of the, not the middle of the Atlantic, but, you know, several hundred miles offshore. And, you know, it's one of these situations where you wake up in the middle of the night and your stomach feels off, you know, and at first it doesn't seem that bad. It seems like, like a little upset stomach. So you try to go back to sleep, and it kind of gets worse and worse, and you toss and you turn, and, your stomach's getting more and more screwed up. And then next thing you know, it's like, I'm going to throw up. Well, I was full-on food poisoning. I was throwing up while having diarrhea, not to gross you all out. And of course, the head on this boat was located all the way up at the front of the boat and beating into like 15 to 20 knot seas. And so, you know, it was like riding a bucking bronco while having diarrhea and puking with food poisoning. So that was a lot of fun. That's never happened to me before. But anyways... And I got one more delivery I got to do after this one. Take a Valiant 42 up from Fort Lauderdale to the Chesapeake Bay, and I've got to do one short trip up north somewhere, Chesapeake Bay to Cape Cod or something like that, and then it's going to be over. This particular boat actually has some sentimental value, I guess you could say, or historical value. When I was sailing around the Americas near the end of the expedition, my friend Simon Edwards, who's a delivery captain, he's sailed over 400,000 miles, and he's been delivering boats. You know, he's delivered every different kind of boat you can imagine. And so he was coming up from the Caribbean on a delivery, and he found me on that little Alban Vega. I was about 300 days into that trip. I was on the home stretch, you know. I was getting close. Well, you know, I still had hundreds of miles to go, but I didn't have thousands of miles to go. You know, it was a 27,000-mile trip, so when you only have hundreds of miles to go, it's not that bad. So anyways, he finds me out, 600 miles from shore, out in the Atlantic, and at that point, my wind generator was the only source of power that I had. My engine had broke back in the Pacific, and my solar panels had rotted out long before that. I had horrible piece of junk solar panels on that boat at that time. And so, don't buy SunSea panels. I haven't seen SunSea panels in some time. I'm guessing they either stopped making it or people stopped buying it because they're horrible pieces of junk. But anyways, I had no way to charge anything. You know, I was on this little boat, and the only system I had was this one old wind generator, a Rutland wind generator, and I got hit a few days before this by a squall that blew about 50 knots in the middle of the night. It was actually on my birthday. I got hit by this squall, and it burned out the wind generator. The wind generator was already acting up at this point. It was sort of cutting in and out. It was an old wind generator to begin with. You know, I didn't have proper sponsorship on that trip. I would have loved to have had a new wind generator. I would have loved to have had a Valiant 40. But I just, you know, the funding for that trip was abysmal. So anyways, my friend Simon, he finds me out in the ocean. And it was very light winds at that point. I was just sort of bobbing around like a cork. And I needed to charge my computer, my sat phone. I had no way to charge anything because I had no way, you know, I had no engine, no solar panels, no wind generator, and my batteries were dead. So he took a line and wrapped it around a cooler and threw it at me, and I pulled the cooler over to the boat, and I put my computer, my sat phone, anything that needed charge, my iPad or my little iPod, iPod Touch, so I could listen to music. I put all of it in a dry bag, stuck it in the cooler, and threw the line back to him. He pulled it over, and he actually spent the night about a half mile away, hove to. Like I said, there wasn't much wind anyways. He was hove to, and I was hove to, and he charged all of my electronics for me, which was really nice. And so the next day, he floated this cooler back to me, and he put a little bit of fresh food in there, and he had a few beers, which were really, really good, and all my computer and sat phone and everything was charged back up. Again, everything lost power, but anyways, the long and short of the story is that this is the boat that he was on. It was this 54-foot Beneteau called Helena. And so it's pretty interesting that 5 years later, it's almost 5 years to the day later, I am delivering this very same boat that he was on, up from the Bahamas to the Chesapeake. Now, when people hear delivery, they're like, you know, when I say I'm delivering a boat up from the Bahamas, or I'm delivering a boat to the Caribbean, all people hear is that word Bahamas, you know, or Caribbean. What they don't realize is you fly into the Bahamas, you're there for like 4 hours, 5 hours, however long it takes to go to the grocery store and maybe go to a fuel dock and just get the boat ready. And then you head out to sea. I mean, you really don't spend any time in the Bahamas. You spend all the time out in the ocean. And when you go to the Caribbean, it's the same thing. I mean, you spend, you know, somewhere between 9 and 12 days in the ocean, getting from Annapolis down to the Virgin Islands or Puerto Rico or wherever the boat's going. But when you show up, you're only there for, like, as long as it takes to clean the boat and, what you know, blast all the salt off of it with a hose. And then, basically, you're just on a plane heading right back to where you came from. So you really don't spend much time in these locations, you know. I mean, obviously the owner does. It's almost a little silly in some cases, because I deliver these boats back and forth sometimes year after year for the same owners, and these guys, you know, it's costing them like, I don't know, $600 a day at 10, 11 days plus airfare. You know, it adds up to be $7,000-$8,000 to get this boat delivered down there, and all they do is show up for like a weekend here and a weekend there over the winter, and oh man, I got a freaking door flying around. Hold on. Ugh. There's a door got loose and was flapping around. We got the waves behind us and we're sort of getting knocked around a bit, and a door came free and started flopping. But anyways, you know, so the guy's spending like $7,000-$8,000, getting his boat delivered down for just a few days. You can go down and charter a boat in the Caribbean for like, you know, a couple of thousand, $2,000-$3,000. I mean, it's a whole lot cheaper, but you don't have your fancy boat. I mean, that's what it really comes down to. I mean, and, you know, they'll have their 50-foot Hinckley or their Little Harbor or some really, really nice boat. And granted, you can't charter a boat like that because they're too nice for the charter fleets. And while I'm on chartering for a moment, I think one of the... I wouldn't go as far as calling it a scam, but it's certainly not a good idea. They have this whole deal with these charter fleets where they convince people to buy like one of these Beneteaus, a brand new Beneteau 46 or something like that, and they tell you, well, look, man, you can get this Beneteau at a cheaper price than it's going to cost you brand new, but we're going to have to put it in charter for like 3 years or 5 years or something like that. And then when it's over, you give us some more money, and the boat's yours. And in the end, you're going to get this boat and save $100,000 or $150,000. It sounds really good when you say it like that, you know. And a lot of people sort of fall for this trick. But the problem is, when that boat is in charter, it's going to get destroyed. I mean, people treat charter boats like trash, and they basically get trashed. I mean, they're there to party, you know. They're there to sail around and drink a bunch of rum, and they don't really care about the boat. The boat isn't their boat, you know. I mean, I'm sure some people are very nice to charter boats, but I know a lot of people that have chartered boats and just are really, really hard on it. So basically, after the time has passed, you end up getting your boat back, and you pay them a bunch of money, and yeah, maybe you saved $100,000. But there's $200,000 worth of damage done to the boat. You know, the boat is basically shot because it's just been used and abused time after time after time. So I would highly suggest not falling for that sort of scenario. I would also highly suggest not buying a production boat, period. But there are some good production boats, don't get me wrong. But, you know, for the same price as a production boat, especially a new production boat, I mean, you can spend $400,000. A brand new Beneteau 41 is $400,000. Right now, I can get you a Hylas 46 for $400,000. A 2008 Hylas 46. We got one sitting there in Annapolis at the brokerage. I also sell sailboats, but for Rogue Wave Yacht Sales, which is ultimately David Walters Yacht Sales, we've now combined. But you know, what sense does that make? I mean, a Hylas 46 is an incredibly well-built boat. And, you know, leisure furl, low hours on the engine, low hours on the generator. This is the kind of boat you can sail around the world in luxury. Why in the world would you want to, for the same amount of money, buy a plastic fantastic 41-foot boat when you can get a super high-quality 46-foot boat? You know, it just doesn't make any sense. But people buy these Beneteaus all over, you know, all the time. The Genoes, the Sun Odysseys, you know, I mean, they're all plastic fantastic, you know. And the thing is this, man, we had a really strong market, boat building industry in the United States until about the late 1980s. There was a luxury tax that got put in place, and it shut down a ton of our builders. A whole bunch of boat builders went out of business. They realized this luxury tax was a really bad thing, so they pulled the luxury tax back, but it was too late. The damage had already been done. Beneteau saw this opportunity in the market, and so they took advantage of it. And then we had a recession again in 2008. And 2008 recession basically wiped out whoever was left. People like Valiant, for instance. Island Packet went out of business not too long ago. They've been struggling since the recession. So Beneteau right now controls 50% of the market in the United States. And they control a very large percentage of the market globally. So anyways, as I was saying earlier, you know, for the same price as a production boat, you can get a real nice high-quality blue water boat. So it doesn't make any sense to me why people are buying these things, unless you just want a floating condo, because that's all these are. These are floating condos, basically. So, yeah, I mean, everything's about compromise. When it comes to sailboats, it's all compromise. And if that's what you want, great. If you just want to sail around in the Chesapeake Bay or sail around in the Caribbean on your floating condo, then by all means, get a production boat. But if you want to do some real blue water sailing, there's a whole lot of other boats out there that you can get at a good price. But anyways, we got to go to commercials.
Our aim at Street Invest is to put a trustworthy adult into the lives of street children so that they can support them in creating the most positive paths for their lives in the future. We work around the world, working on the street with the children where they are. For such a large group of children, the amount of funding available is tiny. Really, the funding that keeps organisations like Street Invest going comes from individual donors. Street children are the most abused, neglected, violated children, yet they are also the most resourceful, responsive, and resilient children that we could have the honour of working with.
For more information or to make a donation, visit streetinvest.org.
Okay, welcome back to Ocean Research Project. I am Matt Rutherford, sitting in the V berth of a Beneteau 54, which I am delivering from the Bahamas up to the Chesapeake Bay. Right now, the weather is really nice. The weather has been pretty nice the whole trip, but we got some nasty stuff coming around Cape Hatteras, so I'll probably heave to for a few hours. It's a fast-moving system. It's typical this time of year. Systems, you know, they like a nor'easter, for instance, and this might be a nor'easter. I mean, if it blows 35 out of the northeast, I'll consider it a nor'easter. But they don't last anywhere near as long this time of year as they do in the winter. You know, in the winter, a nor'easter can last for days and blow 50, 60 knots even. But this time of year, they tend to come for breakfast and leave after dinner. At least that's the old saying. And so they don't last very long. But anyways, so this is the sort of Ocean Research Project podcast 2.0. So I want to sort of divide things up into a few different categories here. So, I'd like to talk about boat handling, techniques, tactics, gear, all that sort of stuff in one part, environmental-related marine issues in another part, and also continue telling my sailing stories, because I got a whole lot of them, and we still got a long way to go through the story of my trip around the Americas. So, to move on to sort of the environmental situation, this is something I don't really understand. And that is that the reluctance of people to accept climate change. Now, we got to take a step back and look at this situation and how did we get to this point? How did we get to the place where if you're a Democrat, you believe one thing, if you're a Republican, you believe something else? Like, how did it get here? So, Al Gore lost the election in 2000 to George Bush. And when Al Gore lost the election, he started doing this, you know, heavily campaigning stuff on global warming. He did this Inconvenient Truth. He actually, I believe, was given a Nobel Peace Prize for sort of, his championing of the cause of global warming. And by doing so, it was completely on accident. But by doing so, Al Gore got the issue of climate change all wrapped up in politics. Now, at the same time, instead of Al Gore, had it been John McCain or George Bush, who is sort of championing the cause of climate change, it's very possible that Republicans would believe in climate change and Democrats would think it's a hoax. I mean, that's basically what had happened on the flip side. So anyways, of course, it was Al Gore, and so it became this scenario where, you know, the politics are in the United States and have been for some time is such a volatile black and white sort of world. You know, people want to tear each other down. They don't want to work with each other anymore. The parties are more and more reluctant to come together for the greater good. Instead, they just want to bicker and just tear at each other. So anyways, Al Gore accidentally got this whole issue embedded in it. You know, he was saying global warming, and it got to the point where you can't even say global warming anymore. You know, now people say climate change. But what I don't really understand about this is if you had a problem with your car, who would you listen to about that problem? Would you listen to a politician or a mechanic? Let's say you had a problem with your health. Who would you listen to, a politician or a doctor? If there's a problem with the environment, who are you going to listen to, a politician or a scientist? You know, it just doesn't make any sense. Of course you're going to listen to a scientist. And, you know, there's overwhelming scientific evidence that something is happening to the climate. And that things are getting warmer. You know, we're having year after year of these record-breaking heat. You know, I'm reading a book right now about explorers in the Arctic. It was a book written a couple hundred years ago about some of the early Arctic expeditions. And these are some places that I've sailed three times now, between Greenland and Canada, Baffin Bay, Davis Straits, all this area. And, you know, I'm reading this stuff today, and they're talking about, you know, late June and July and raising up their sails and the fog, and the fog actually freezes on their sails and on their ropes and lines, and so they can't even get their sails down because the lines are frozen solid and the sails are frozen solid. And, you know, I'm thinking, man, I've been up there in the same exact place in the same exact time of year three times now, three different years. I have never experienced anything even remotely that cold. You know, and so the big question really should be not about this: is climate change happening, or is climate change real, or is climate change a hoax? The real question should be: is climate change man-made? We all know that the climate changes. You know, I mean, there was an ice age like 10,000 years ago, or ended 10,000 years ago. So obviously, the Earth gets warmer and the Earth gets cooler. You know, there was estimated 17 ice ages in the last million years. Imagine that, 17 ice ages. So, you know, this happens. And 3 million years ago, the Earth was so warm, there was no ice on either polar cap. It was all basically melted. And the sea levels were a whole lot higher than they are today. So, okay, climate change exists. So to deny climate change is just silly. Now, the million-dollar question is man the cause, or is man contributing to the cause? Well, you know, the ocean acidification is sort of climate change's smoking gun. And when I say that, it's because we had about 280 parts per million of CO2 in the atmosphere before the Industrial Revolution. We now have 400 parts per million of CO2 in the atmosphere today. The last time this happened on Earth, it took about 10,000 years, and we've done it in like 200 and some years. So we've done it a whole lot faster than it has happened previously. Now, even if there's the most slightest remote chance that man is having effect on climate, even though smallest chance, we need to look into that, and we need to look into it and research the hell out of it, because the possible outcomes are catastrophic. You know, I mean, think about sea level rise, for instance. I mean, sea level rise is going to catch us completely with our pants down, you know, if we're not careful. How many coastal towns exist? You know, historically speaking, a lot of the major cities were near the ocean because of trade. So, I mean, it's not just the United States. I mean, you can look at New York and Miami, and, you know, you can look at L.A., and you look in Asia, look in Europe, all over the world. There's major metropolitan cities and a whole variety of small towns located right by the ocean. There's nothing in place to deal with heightened sea level rise, because it's all the ocean has basically always been at the generally the same place since those things were built. So, you know, and it isn't just sea level rise, like the sea slowly rising up and drowning these cities. It's really the storm surge that's the biggest issue. We're going to have an increased storm surge, which is going to batter a lot of these coastal towns. So, you know, that's a really big... I mean, there's a lot of other potential problems with climate change, obviously. The issue of weather patterns changing, so you get rain in places that usually have droughts, and you get droughts in places where there's usually rain. There's all sorts of different theories out there. I mean, there's also an idea that if enough ice were to melt off of Greenland and enough fresh water to get into the ocean, that it could change the Gulf Stream and the way that the Gulf Stream flows. I mean, that's sort of a doomsday theory, and, you know, there's a lot of sort of doomsday theories out there that I sort of take with a, you know, a grain of salt. You know, I'm not a big conspiracy guy, so, but, you know, I think it's important to look at, as I said earlier, you know, look at the people. These scientists, they spend their whole lives, you know, just like a mechanic spends his whole life working on a car, you know, a scientist spend their whole lives working on these issues. And when a scientist has to write a scientific paper, it's peer-reviewed, which means that a whole bunch of other scientists look at this scientific paper and question everything that's in it. And these scientists will very happily say that the information in this paper is bogus. And they have no problem at all telling the scientists who wrote that no, we're not going to publish this paper because we don't believe this. So it's not an easy thing to get a paper published as a scientist. There's a whole protocol involved in the situation. It's not like they just write something and throw it out there into freaking the internet or something, you know? So an overwhelming amount of these papers are saying that man is having effect on the environment. I've heard numbers as high as 92%. You know, I've also heard arguments where people say, oh, that's not quite correct. It's not really that high. It's more like 75%. Okay, so let's just say it's 75%. All right, 75% of the scientific papers that are written about climate says that climate change is real. I got somebody stomping around above my head right now. I guess my crew is up there. I don't know what my crew would be up there doing right now. I better have a tether on, I guess. But anyways, so 75%. Let's take that number. Now, let's say 75% of mechanics told you should change your oil every 3,000 miles. And 25% of mechanics said, nah, you can change your oil every 10,000 miles. Who are you going to listen to? Let's say 75% of doctors said smoking is going to give you cancer. Who are you going to listen to? Are you going to listen to the 75% or are you going to listen to the 25% that say, you know, nah, man, smoking is fine, it's not going to hurt you? You know, I know it sounds silly when it's said in that manner, but that's really the situation. And 75% is a lowball figure. I do think the number is closer to 80 or 90% of scientific papers, back this idea that man is having an effect. So why the hesitation? Like, why reduce funding? That's really, I guess, a big thing I don't understand is if there's even the slightest chance that this is real, then we need to be doing more research. Because it's potentially catastrophic. And, you know, at the same time, if you believe that climate change is a hoax, then we need to do more research so you can prove it's a hoax. Either way, we need to do more research. Why in the world would you cut funding for climate research? It just doesn't make sense. Like, what are you afraid of? Like, what are you afraid that people are going to find? You know, it baffles me. And of course, I'm saying this because the current administration in power in the United States right now very much wants to cut funding for climate change research. And I don't know how bad it's going to get. I've waited the first 100 days before I've said anything about it. I didn't want to sit here and bash the current administration until I wanted to give them 100 days. You know, I want to see politicians say a lot of things when they're running for office. It doesn't mean that what they say they're actually going to do. Like, for instance, I seriously doubt anybody's going to ever build a wall between the United States and Mexico. And the Mexicans are certainly not going to pay for it. That's all just a bunch of crazy talk. But so you want to give time and see what are the politicians actually going to do. And yeah, I mean, everything I could tell, and, you know, I'm talking to a lot of different scientists who are climate scientists who, you know, we've been working with NASA and climate scientists at NASA and Smithsonian. And there's a lot of concerns right now that things are in the works to reduce the funding, not just for organizations like NASA. It's very easy to change NASA's funding if you're the president. The current administration, because NASA's government, it's very easy for the administration to be like, nope, you're not doing any more climate research. Why don't you go research like the moon or some, or a mission to Mars or something else? But the real problem is if they pressure the National Science Foundation into not giving out grants for climate research. Because the vast majority, or a large percentage at least, of science is funded, climate science, is funded by grants from the National Science Foundation or from NOAA. And so if the government can control that flow of funding, then there's not going to be any money for climate research. You know, and we're actually falling behind a bit. You know, there's other countries, even China right now. China is investing, you know, more money into climate-related research than we are. I mean, it's just, it's sort of getting silly. So, yeah, I mean, I don't want to go on and on about this forever. You know, it really baffles me. I just don't understand it. Like, if you think it's a hoax, then let's do more research and prove it's a hoax. Like, what do you got to lose? If it even has the slightest chance of being a reality, then my God, the possible outcome, it could be absolutely catastrophic, you know. And so, you know, we need to do more research, and let the data speak for itself. You know, when we do climate research up in the Arctic, you know, like we did for the last 2 years for NASA and Smithsonian and Woods Hole, all this stuff, when we're doing that research, you know, we don't have an agenda. I'm not trying to prove anything. I'm not trying to prove climate change exists. I'm not trying to prove it doesn't exist. I'm just trying to collect professional-grade scientific data, and I want the data to speak for itself. I don't speak for the data. The data will speak for itself. So anyways, we got to cut to commercial. All right.
I'm John Herlig. In Postcards from Sea, I tell stories of my travels aboard Ave Del Mar, my 1967 Rawson cutter. I deal with serious nautical issues like how to sail your mast into a tree on a canal, what kind of incense best covers the aroma of kimchi fermenting on your boat, or whether or not I can beat a leukemia patient at a video game. It's simply the story of my life, and my life happens to take place on a 50-year-old sailboat with no particular destination in mind. I hope you'll join me and some of the wonderful characters I meet as I travel for my show, Postcards from Sea, every other Monday here on Boat Radio.
Time goes forward, go and catch your jet, you will find your moment. Time goes forward, stay and have a sniff, let's dream about the future.
Bonnie Lass Charters is Mallorca's number one experience.
Bonnie Lass is a 57-foot converted fishing boat. She was built in 1949 as a herring ring netter in Scotland, and now she's set up for the Mediterranean. Apart from just relaxing in the sunshine on the deck, there's paddleboarding and any kind of exploring you can imagine up along the north coast of Mallorca here, quite often with Maggie the dog in tow as well. Bonnie Lass Charters is unique because no charter is really the same. We work really hard to make it the perfect day for each individual client. To be able to go out and enjoy the day with the guests on board is just fantastic.
For more information and to make a booking, visit bonnielasscharters.com.
Okay, welcome back to Ocean Research Project. This is Matt Rutherford sitting in a V-berth of a Beneteau 54, 100 miles or so southeast of Hatteras, just sailing along at, I don't know, 7, 8 knots. So, try to think where we were last time. I think I ended my last story at a single-handed transatlantic in 2008. And then I got over to England, and they thought I was a single-hander that was bringing in a bunch of cocaine, 100 kilos of coke, and they searched the hell out of me. And of course, I didn't have any cocaine. I was just a single-hander crossing the ocean. Anyways, if you want to hear that story in more detail, you got to listen to the last podcast. So I show up over, and this happens. I get searched, whatever. All that passes by, and eventually I start. The Coast Guard went on strike, which was interesting. It's hard to even imagine a Coast Guard going on strike in the United States. But because of that, they would still rescue people, but they weren't giving any forecasts. And this is the English Coast Guard. So I couldn't get any forecasts on the radio, and I was having a hard time, like, getting the weather, and I wanted to sail to Ireland, and so I just left. I got the best forecast I could, and I just left to go to Ireland, and it was pretty light winds. I remember passing not too far from Fastnet Rock. I was heading to Southwest Ireland to Kerry. People do, like, the Ring of Kerry by car. I was going to do the Ring of Kerry by sailboat, basically. As I was passing this place, the Bull and the Bear, these two big giant rocks, and there's a lot of current, and I started heading in the Kenmare River. Kenmare River isn't a river in the traditional sense. It's like southwest coast of Ireland is very jagged. It looks like big jagged teeth or something on a monster, you know? So the Kenmare River could be also considered a bay, I guess, or a sound. But for whatever reason, they call it a river. Anyways, I turn in this, and I've got another 10, 15 miles at least. Maybe it's longer than that. I can't remember very well. Maybe it was 20 miles to sail into this river before I get to the anchorage. And just as I turn, the wind starts picking up faster and faster. And by the time I get to where this little harbor is and pull in, you know, it's blowing like 30 knots. And not too long after, it's blowing like 50 knots. And I find a mooring ball, and I grab a mooring ball and row over to land, and it's raining sideways. And I'm out there trying to hitchhike on the side of the road. I'm about 2 miles outside of the town of Sneem. Sneem is this little tiny town. So some guy picks me up. I'm soaking wet, and I don't really hitchhike much. I don't know if hitchhiking is something even people even do in Ireland, but I was trying. I didn't feel like walking 2 miles in the rain. So I get into town, and I get in the bar, and it's blowing 50 or something offshore, and I start, you know, I figure out the weather, and what happened was a hurricane had, they call it an old hurricane, a hurricane had crossed the Atlantic, and it diminished down to about 50 knots, so it wasn't hurricane strength anymore, but it was still a big system, and it slammed right into the southwest coast of Ireland. I got really lucky that I made it in the Kenmare River just before this storm hit, because if it would have hit when I was down by Fastnet, it could have got really, really bad. So anyways, I ended up getting basically adopted by this Irish family. I kept my boat on a mooring ball, and this guy was a Shawnee, and I went around. I couldn't understand. A Shawnee is a traditional Irish storyteller, and I went around Ireland with him for a few weeks, and I was the guy at the door who was, you know, handing out the tickets, and he would do these shows with his heavy accent. I couldn't understand what he was saying half the time, but you know, it was really nice. And then I got back in a boat, and I sailed up the west coast of Ireland a bit, and you know, the west coast of Ireland has a lot of cliffs. There's some pretty strong currents. It's a pretty place, but you know, it was also very gray that summer. It was a lot of rain. It was actually one of the wettest summers in, like, I don't know, the last 50 years. So it was basically, it wasn't like heavy rain, it was like light mist the entire time. But you know, it was a pretty good sail around. And you know, I went into places in West Ireland where you'd go into a bar and they didn't even speak English. They would only speak Gaelic. And you know, that was really interesting. I mean, it obviously didn't help my ability to have a conversation with anybody. And of course, by this point, I'm dying to talk to somebody. Being a single-hander in the ocean, it's not a big deal. But being a single-hander when you're coastal cruising actually sucks. Because, you know, when you're near land, there's people around and you want to talk to people. And, you know, in the middle of the ocean, there's nobody around, so it doesn't really matter. And so it's actually really hard to be a single-hander. It's really lonely being a single-hander when you're coastal cruising, I find it, at least. You know, I've done a lot of single-handing, but it's very different than the ocean. So eventually, after, I don't know, a month or so of sailing around Ireland, I sailed back to southwest England and start heading down the English Channel, bouncing between England and France, sailing my way over. I didn't even know really where I was going. I had heard of this marina, and I heard about it in England, I heard about it in Ireland. It was like an old wives' tale, like some kind of fairy tale. It was called Sixhaven, and I heard that there's this marina called Sixhaven in Amsterdam, and that it was really, really cheap. I didn't even know if it existed on Earth, if it was just a rumor. I didn't know anything with it. You know, I tried to Google it. I didn't really find anything. And so I figured, what the hell? I'm going to try to find this this mystery marina. And so I'm sailing along, and I get to Dover. Dover is on the southeast coast of England. After Dover, you end up going in the North Sea. There's no really good anchorage in Dover. I wasn't going into any marinas. Marinas are expensive, you know. It's like getting a hotel. And at this point, this is in 2008, the euro was at an all-time high versus the dollar. So, you know, my dollar was very weak compared to the euro. And so I was, and also the pound, of course. The pound was really strong. And, you know, it made it really hard to go to spend any money. And so I didn't have money for a marina. That's like getting a hotel or something. It's like getting a hotel every single night. So I would drop anchor sometimes. You know, it was like renegade anchoring. I would drop anchor places where it was sort of allowed, but not really, sort of frowned upon. But, you know, they're not going to really kick you out, but they might come over and bug you. Like, why are you anchored here? So Dover was sort of one of those places. And it was a really, really rough anchorage. I remember Whitecaps being there. There's a lot of ferries that come and go, like really big ferries, like 400 feet. And they kick big wakes, so you're bouncing around. I mean, it's a really uncomfortable anchorage, but I didn't really have any choice, you know. I mean, I needed somewhere to stop and recoup before I crossed the North Sea. And I left out, and, you know, I crossed the North Sea heading over to Amsterdam, and it was getting cold. By this point, it's November. And it's November, and I'm sailing in the North Sea, and there's like this rain, sleet, you know, it's not quite ice and snow, but it's damn close to it. And I'm sitting out there, and I'm thinking, man, this is just crazy. You know, I'm freezing my ass off, and there's freighters all over the place, and I'm going through these areas that were, like, full of oil wells, you know, oil rigs, I should say, oil rigs out in the ocean. And they were really trippy at nighttime. I remember at one point I had been up at this, you know, I'd been up for probably 24 hours being cold and wet, and, you know, I was slightly delusional. And I remember sailing right through the middle of all these oil rigs, and they were all lit up. And they sort of looked like mushrooms, like big in the darkness, you know, with the lights on. It looked like big giant mushrooms all around me that I was sailing by. I did, you know, I was a bit delusional, like I said. And anyways, eventually I get to the harbor there. It's not really a harbor. It's the entrance to the Ijmir, which is a totally terrible pronunciation of this, of the canal. This is the main canal that leads from the North Sea over to Amsterdam. It's, I think Amsterdam's about 15 miles down this canal, and there's a big giant mega lock you have to go through. And so whatever, I go through the lock, and I have an American flag flying off the back of my boat. And the guys tell me to pull over when I get through the lock and tie off to this dock. And so, okay, sure, whatever, I do it. And they come and they board me with the police. And the two guys, the custom guys, pulled me off the boat. So I was standing, like, on the dock next to the boat. And these police guys went on the boat without me and started searching the boat. I guess, I don't know, maybe they thought I was going to hide something. But I'm looking at these guys, and I'm dumbfounded. And, you know, I'm like, come on, man, like, what could I possibly be bringing to Amsterdam that you guys don't already have? Like, what am I going to bring, drugs? Like, you guys got drugs. You guys got tons of drugs. Like, what is it? What do you think I got, you know? So anyways, they searched me going into Amsterdam, which I thought was really funny. But I go down this canal, you know, whatever, 15 miles or so, whatever it was something like that. And I tie off to the seawall on the side. I didn't know where the Sixhaven was, you know. But I'm right across from the train station, the main train station in Amsterdam. And I tie up. The really interesting thing about these canals in the Netherlands is that the water stays deep all the way up to the side of the canal. So you go right up to the side of the canal, and there was nothing to tie off to, so I tied off to trees. You know, put the line around the trunk of a tree. And actually, I tied off to trees several different times. So anyways, I tied off the trees, and I walk into Amsterdam. And by this point, I don't know, I've been awake for like 48 hours or 50 hours. I've been awake for a long time. It was a rough crossing in the North Sea, and it was cold, and it was wet. And you know, I got my boat tied off the trees, and I take this little ferry, this little free ferry across the canal over to the train station. And it's a very short walk from there into Amsterdam. And I go to a coffee shop, some little Rasta, you know, coffee shop, and get a little bag of ganja. And I was very smart by not smoking anything right there and then. And I just turned around and went back to the boat. And, you know, I hadn't smoked anything in a long time. And this, you know, I was completely floored, like completely floored. Like I couldn't get up. Like I would have been like, it would have been really embarrassing if I had smoked this in the coffee shop. Cause I'd been like laying on the floor, like drooling on myself. And it just knocked me out, like completely knocked out. And so I wake up in the morning, and my dumbass, I had a really nice fishing rod in a rod holder on the back of my boat, and I didn't even think about it. And when I was passed out, somebody stole my fishing rod, which was the only time in the entire trip that anybody stole anything, was sitting there in Amsterdam. So the next day, I find the Sixth Haven. The Sixth Haven's actually right next to me. I sort of suspected it was it. I saw some masts, so I went over, and I go into Sixth Haven. I walk in there and talk to the guy. You know, what do we need to do? I'd like to keep my boat here for the winter. And he says, okay, it's going to be 500 euro. And I think, okay, 500 euro a month? And he's like, no, 500 euro for the entire winter, for like 5 months. You know, like 100 euro a month. I mean, that's the cheapest. I mean, I couldn't believe how cheap the place was. And it was like all these fairy tales that I've been hearing in England and Ireland about this super cheap marina. It was actually true. And I found it. And so anyways, I pulled my boat in. The slip was so tight, I think I had like a half an inch on either side of my boat when I came through the initial pilings. But whatever, it was tight, but you know, who cares? I tied my boat off, and it was a place I could keep it for the winter. I didn't have any money at this point. I gave him the 500 euro, which is basically all the money I had left, except for money for a plane ticket. I hung out in Amsterdam for about another week or so. I wasn't feeling very social at the time, and I don't know, I just didn't feel like going into bars and talking to people. I don't know, I guess I can be that way sometimes, a bit introverted. But I ran out of money, so I got a plane ticket and flew to Austin, Texas, of all places, and I spent that winter as a Alfa Romeo mechanic. I was rebuilding Alfa Romeo Spiders, only old Alfa Romeo Spiders. Alfa Romeo Spiders are an interesting vehicle. The Germans make cars very meticulously, like robots, and the Italians make cars like they're making love. You know, I don't know. To work on an Alfa, you gotta like massage the head gasket while whispering sweet nothings up the exhaust pipe. You know, they're not quite like any other car. But a really good thing about an old Alfa is there's really no electronics, and there's plenty of room in there to move a wrench. You know, you open the hood on a new car, I don't even know what to do. I mean, it's like, where do I even start? And there's no room in there to turn any wrenches, you know? So anyways, I did this for, you know, a few months in the wintertime, and lived in an Alfa Romeo junkyard, and worked on old... I'm not a mechanic, by the way. I mean, it's not like I'm like some great mechanic. You know, I was like the bottom of the rung guy, you know, doing basic stuff like changing alternators and, you know, rotating tires, and you know, I was doing fairly basic stuff. But anyways, you know, I had to rebuild the cruising kitty. I had to get money again, so I did that, and went back to Amsterdam in April, and it was cold. I got the one of like the worst flus I ever had in my life on the airplane back to Amsterdam. And you know, you get sick riding airplanes sometimes. It happens, but this was like absolutely exceptional. And I get on my boat. The boat has been closed up all winter in Amsterdam. And Amsterdam was more cold and wet that winter than it was, like, you know, icy. And so there was mold broke out all over my boat. I get back, I open the door, and mold is freaking everywhere. And it's musty and wet and cold, and I'm sick. And then I just get sicker. I'm, like, bedridden for 2 days. I'm so sick I can't even get out of bed, and I don't have really any food on the boat, and it's all cold. It's like 40 degrees on the boat. I can't get it warm, and I don't have any way to plug into European power because I don't have anything to convert 220, and it was really miserable. And eventually, 2 days later, after sitting there basically living off of nothing but water in this cold, clammy, wet boat, I dragged myself down to the store and get some real food, and I got a bottle of Jägermeister, which we always joked about was, you know, cough syrup, and drank Jägermeister and spent the next couple days trying to, you know, drink soup and Jäger, and nurse myself back. And yeah, so I'll leave the story there. Of course, I continue sailing on down to Africa and across the Caribbean and so on. So I'm also working for Rogue Wave Yacht Sales, which is part of David Walters in Annapolis, and I act as a buyer's agent. So basically, I help people find the sailboat that's right for you. So depending on how much money you have to spend, how many people are going to be on the boat, where are you going, what are you doing, there's an ocean of used sailboats out there. And what I try to do is help you find the most turnkey possible boat that's going to fit your needs. You don't want to be the guy who puts $50,000 into a boat. You want to be the guy who buys the boat that had $50,000 put into it, you know? So anyways, if you have interest in buying a boat, please contact me at matt@roguewaveyachtsales.com. Also, check out the website, oceanresearchproject.org, where you can see videos from last year's expedition, and you can donate to the cause. And, you know, welcome back to Ocean Research Project. I'm glad that we're off and running again, and I'll talk to you here soon.
Unum ko na uswag.
Doon na kasi. Kuya na gurok. Kuya na kasi.
Kuya na uswag. Sudah kelima bagus.